"You crazy bitch," Fred said. He pushed his face pale, sweaty, the eyes seeming ready to pop right out of their sockets, close enough to hers for her to feel the spray of his spittle. "Anything you say can and will be used against your crazy ass." On the other side of the street, diners were pouring out of Sweetbriar Rose, Barbie among them still wearing his apron and baseball cap. Julia Shumway arrived first. She took in the scene, not seeing details so much as a gestalt summation. Dead dog, clustered cops, bleeding, screaming woman with one shoulder higher than the other, bald cop, Freddie goddamn Denton, shaking her by the arm connected to that shoulder, more blood on the steps, suggesting that Piper had fallen down them, or had been pushed. Julia did something she had never done before in her life, reached into her handbag, flipped her wallet open, and climbed the steps, holding it out, yelling, "Press! Press! Press!" It stopped the shaking, at least. 9. 10 minutes later, in the office that had been Duke Perkins not so long ago, Carter Thibodeau sat on the sofa under Duke's framed pictures and certificates, with a fresh bandage on his shoulder and paper towels around his hand. Georgia was sitting beside him. Large beads of pain sweat stood out on Thibodeau's forehead. But after saying, "I don't think nothing's broken," he was silent. Fred Denton sat in a chair in the corner. His gun was on the chief's desk. He had surrendered it willingly enough, only saying, "I had to do it. Just look at Cart's hand." Piper sat in the office chair that was now Peter Randolph's. Julia had mopped most of the blood off Piper's face with more paper towels. The woman was shivering with shock and in great pain, but she was as silent about it as Thibodeau. Her eyes were clear.
"Clover only attacked him."
She raised her chin to Carter.
"After, he pushed me down the stairs. The push caused me to lose hold of my leash. What my dog did was justified. He was protecting me from a criminal assault."
"She attacked us," Georgia cried. "Crazy bitch attacked us. Came up the steps spouting all this shit."
"Shut up," Barbie said. "All of you, shut the hell up." He looked at Piper. "This isn't the first time you've dislocated your shoulder, is it?" "I want you out of here, Mr. Barbara," Randolph said, but he spoke with no great conviction. "I can deal with this," Barbie said. "Can you?" Randolph made no reply. Mel Searles and Frank the Lessop stood outside the door. They looked worried. Barbie turned back to Piper. "This is a subluxation, a partial separation. Not bad. I can pop it back in before you go to the hospital."
"Hospital?"
Fred Denton squawked.
"She's under arrest."
"Shut up, Freddy," Randolph said. "Nobody's under arrest. At least, not yet." Barbie held Piper's eyes with his own. "But I have to do it now, before the swelling gets bad. If you wait for Everett to do it at the hospital, they'll have to give you anesthesia." He leaned close to her ear and murmured, "While you're out, they'll be telling their side, and you won't be telling yours." "What are you saying?" Randolph asked sharply. "That it's going to hurt," Barbie said. "Right, Rev?" She nodded.
"Go on. Coach Gromley did it right on the sidelines, and she was a total dope. Just hurry. And please, don't screw it up."
Barbie said, "Julia, grab a sling from the first aid kit, then help me lie her down on her back." Julia, very pale and feeling ill, did as she was told. Barbie sat down on the floor to Piper's left, slipped off one shoe, and then grasped her forearm just above her wrist with both hands. "I don't know Coach Gromley's method," he said, "but this is how a medic I knew in Iraq did it. You're going to count to three, and then yell wishbone."
"Wishbone," Piper said, bemused in spite of the pain. "Well, okay. You're the doctor."
No, Julia thought. Rusty Everett was now the closest thing the town had to a doctor. She'd contacted Linda and gotten his cell phone number, but her call had been immediately shunted to voicemail. The room was silent. Even Carter Thibodeau was watching. Barbie nodded to Piper. Beads of sweat stood out on her forehead. But she had her game face on, and Barbie respected the shit out of that. He slipped his sock foot into her left armpit, snugging it tight. Then, while pulling slowly but steadily on her arm, he applied counter pressure with his foot. "Okay, here we go. Let's hear you.
One, two, three,
Wishbone!
When Piper shouted, Barbie pulled. Everyone in the room heard the loud thunk as the joint went back into place. The hump in Piper's blouse magically disappeared. She screamed but didn't pass out. He slipped the sling over her neck and around the arm, immobilizing it as well as he could. Better? He asked.
Better, she said. Much, thank God. Still hurts, but not as bad.
I've got some aspirin in my purse, Julia said. Give her the aspirin and then get out, Randolph said. All of you, except for Carter, Freddy, the Reverend, and me.
Julia looked at him unbelievingly.
Are you kidding? The Reverend is going to the hospital. Can you walk, Piper?
Piper stood up shakily.
I think so. A little way.
Sit down, Reverend Libby, Randolph said, but Barbie knew she was already gone. He could hear it in Randolph's voice.
Why don't you make me?
She gingerly lifted her left arm in the sling holding it. The arm trembled, but it was working.
I'm sure you can dislocate it again very easily. Go on, show these boys that you're just like them.
And I'll put it all in the paper, Julia said brightly. Circulation will double.
Barbie said, suggest you defer this business until tomorrow, Chief. Allow the lady to get some painkillers stronger than aspirin, and have those knee lacerations checked by Everett. Given the dome, she's hardly a flight risk.
Her dog tried to kill me, Carter said. In spite of the pain, he sounded calm again.
Chief Randolph, the Lesseps, Searles, and Thibodeau are guilty of rape.
Piper was swaying now. Julia put an arm around her, but her voice was firm and clear.
Rue is an accessory to rape.
The hell I am, Georgia squawked. They need to be suspended immediately.
She's lying, Thibodeau said.
Chief Randolph looked like a man watching a tennis match. He finally settled his gaze on Barbie. Are you telling me what to do, kiddo?
No, sir, just making a suggestion based on my enforcement experience in Iraq.
You'll make your own decisions. Randolph relaxed. Okay, then. Okay.
He looked down, frowning in thought. They all watched him notice his fly was still unzipped and take care of that little problem.
Then he looked up again and said, Julia, take Reverend Piper to the hospital. As for you, Mr. Barbara, I don't care where you go, but I want you out of here. I'll take statements from my officers tonight, and from Reverend Libby tomorrow.
Wait, Thibodeau said.
He extended his crooked fingers to Barbie.
Can you do anything about these?
I don't know, Barbie said. Pleasantly enough, he hoped.
The initial ugliness was over, and now came the political aftermath, which he remembered well from dealing with Iraqi cops who were not all that different from the man on the couch and the others crowding the doorway. What it came down to was making nice with people you wished you could spit on.
Can you say wishbone?
10. Rusty had turned his cell phone off before knocking on Big Jim's door. Now Big Jim sat behind his desk, Rusty in the seat before it, the chair of supplicants and applicants. The study, Rennie probably called it a home office on his tax returns, had a pleasant piney smell, as if it had recently been given a good scrubbing, but Rusty still didn't like it. It wasn't just the picture of an aggressively Caucasian Jesus delivering the Sermon on the Mount, or the self-congratulatory plaques, or the hardwood floor that really should have had a rug to protect it. It was all those things, and something else as well. Rusty Everett had very little use for or belief in the supernatural, but nevertheless, this room felt almost haunted.
It's because he scares you a little, he thought. That's all it is.
Hoping that how he felt didn't show in his voice or face, Rusty told Rennie about the hospital's missing propane tanks, about how he had found one of them in the supply shed behind the town hall, currently running the town hall's generator, and how it was the only one.
So, I have two questions, Rusty said. How did a tank from the hospital supply wander downtown? And where did the rest go?
Big Jim rocked back in his chair, put his hands behind his neck, and looked up at the ceiling meditatively. Rusty found himself staring at the trophy baseball sitting on Rennie's desk. Propped in front of it was a note from Bill Lee, once of the Boston Red Sox. He could read the note because it was turned outward. Of course it was. It was for guests to see, to marvel over. Like the pictures on the wall, the baseball proclaimed that Big Jim Rennie had rubbed elbows with famous people. Look on my autographs, ye mighty, and despair. To Rusty, the baseball in the note turned outward seemed to sum up his bad feelings about the room he was in. It was window dressing, a tinny testimonial to small-town prestige and small-town power.
I wasn't aware you had anyone's permission to go poking around in our supply shed, Big Jim remarked to the ceiling. His hammy fingers were still laced together behind his head. Perhaps you're a town official and I wasn't aware of it. If so, my mistake, my bad, as Junior says. I thought you were basically a nurse with a prescription pad.
Rusty thought this was mostly technique, Rennie trying to piss him off, to divert him. I'm not a town official, he said, but I am a hospital employee and a taxpayer.
So?
Rusty could feel blood rushing to his face. So those things make it partly my supply shed. He waited to see if Big Jim would respond to this, but the man behind the desk remained impassive. Besides, it was unlocked, which is all beside the point, isn't it? I saw what I saw, and I'd like an explanation. As a hospital employee. And a taxpayer, don't forget that. Rusty sat looking at him, not even nodding.
I can't give you one, Rennie said.
Rusty raised his eyebrows.
Really, I thought you had your fingers on the pulse of this town. Isn't that what you said the last time you ran for selectman? And now you're telling me you can't explain where the town's propane went?
I don't believe it.
For the first time, Rennie looked nettled.
I don't care if you believe it or not. This is news to me.
But his eyes darted fractionally to one side as he said it, as if to check that his autographed photo of Tiger Woods was still there. The classic liar's tell. Rusty said, The hospital's almost out of LP. Without it, the few of us who are still in the job might as well be working in a Civil War battlefield surgery tent. Our current patients, including a post-coronary and a serious case of diabetes that may warrant amputation, will be in serious trouble if the power goes out. The possible amp is Jimmy Seroy. His car's in the parking lot. It's got a sticker on the bumper that says, Elect Big Jim.
I'll investigate, Big Jim said.
He spoke with the air of a man conferring a favor.
This town's propane is probably stored in some other town facility. As for yours, I'm sure I can't say.
What other town facilities? There's the FD and the sand and salt pile out on God Creek Road. Not even a shed there, but those are the only ones I'm aware of.
Mr. Everett, I'm a busy man. You'll have to excuse me now.
Rusty stood. His hands wanted to ball into fists, but he wouldn't let them. I'm going to ask you one more time, he said, straight out and straight up. Do you know where those missing tanks are?
No.
This time, it was Dale Earnhardt, Rennie's eyes flickered to.
And I'm not going to read any implication into that question, son, because if I did, I'd have to resent it. Now why don't you run along, check on Jimmy Seroy. Tell him Big Jim sends his best, and he'll stop by as soon as the nitpickery slows down a little.
Rusty was still battling to hold on to his temper, but this was a fight he was losing. Run along? I think you forgot that you're a public servant, not a private dictator. For the time being, I'm this town's chief medical officer, and I want some Big Jim's cell rang. He snared it, listened. The lines around his drawn-down mouth grew grimmer.
Gosh darn it, every time I turn my darn back!
He listened some more, then said, If you've got people with you in the office, Pete, shut your trap before you open it too wide and fall right the heck in. Call Andy. I'll be right there, and the three of us will clean this up. He killed the phone and got to his feet. I have to go to the police station. It's either an emergency or more nitpickery. I won't be able to tell which until I get there. And you'll be wanted at either the hospital or the health center, I believe. There seems to be a problem with the Reverend Libby.
Why, what happened to her?
Big Jim's cold eyes surveyed him from hard little sockets.
I'm sure you'll hear her story. I don't know how true it'll be, but I'm sure you'll hear it. So go do your job, young fella, and let me do mine.
Rusty walked down the front hall and out of the house, his temples throbbing. In the west, the sunset was a lurid blood show. The air was almost completely still, but bore a smoky stench just the same. At the foot of the steps, Rusty raised a finger and pointed it at the public servant waiting for him to leave his property before he, Rennie, left himself. Rennie scowled at the finger, but Rusty did not drop it. Nobody needs to tell me to do my job, and I'm going to make looking for that propane part of it. If I find it in the wrong place, someone else is going to be doing your job, Selectman Rennie. That's a promise.
Big Jim flapped a contemptuous hand at him. Get out of here, son. Go to work.
11. During the first 55 hours of the dome's existence, over 24 children suffered seizures. Some, like those of the Everett girls, were noted. Many more were not. And in the days ahead, the seizure activity would rapidly taper down to nothing. Rusty would compare this to the minor shocks people experienced when they came too close to the dome. The first time, you got that almost electric frisson that stiffened the hair on the back of your neck. After that, most people felt nothing. It was as if they had been inoculated.
Are you saying the dome is like chickenpox? Linda asked him later. Catch it once and you're set for life?
Janelle had 2 seizures, and so did a little kid named Norman Sawyer, but in both cases the second seizure was milder than the first, and not accompanied by any babble. Most of the kids Rusty saw had only the one, and there seemed to be no after effects. Only 2 adults had seizures during those first 55 hours. Both came around sunset on Monday evening, and both had easily traceable causes.
With Phil Bushy, a.k.a. the chef, the cause was too much of his own product. Around the time Rusty and Big Jim parted company, Chef Bushy was sitting outside the storage barn behind WCIK, looking dreamily at the sunset. This close to the missile strikes, the scarlet in the sky was further darkened by soot on the dome, his hitty pipe clasped loosely in one hand.
He was tweaked at least to the ionosphere, maybe 100 miles beyond. In the few low-lying clouds which floated on that bloody light, he saw the faces of his mother, his father, his grandfather. He saw Sammy and little Walter as well. All the cloud faces were bleeding. When his right foot began to twitch and then his left foot picked up the beat, he ignored it. Twitching was part of tweaking, everyone knew that. But then his hands began to tremble and his pipe fell into the long grass, yellow and sere as a result of the factory work that went on out here. A moment later, his head began to jerk from side to side. This is it, he thought with a calm that was partly relief. I finally overdid it. I'm checking out. Probably for the best. But he didn't check out. Didn't even pass out. He slid slowly sideways, twitching and watching as a black marble rose in the red sky. It expanded to a bowling ball, then an overinflated beach ball. It went on, growing until it had eaten up the red sky. The end of the world, he thought. Probably for the best. For a moment he thought he was wrong because the stars came out, only they were the wrong color. They were pink, and then, oh God, they began to fall down, leaving long pink trails behind them. Next came fire, a roaring furnace, as if someone had opened a hidden trap door and loosed hell itself on Chester's Mill. It's our treat, he muttered. His pipe pressed against his arm, making a burn he would see and feel later. He lay twitching in the yellow grass with his eyes turned up to glabrous whites that reflected the lurid sunset.
Our Halloween treat. First the trick, then the treat.
The fire was becoming a face, an orange version of the bloody ones he'd been looking at in the clouds just before the fit fell on him. It was the face of Jesus. Jesus was scowling at him and talking to him, telling him that bringing the fire was his responsibility, his, the fire, and the
The purity,
he muttered as he lay in the grass.
No. The purification.
Jesus didn't look so mad now. And he was fading. Why? Because the chef had understood. First came the pink stars, then came the purifying fire. Then the trial would end. The chef stilled as the seizure passed into the first real sleep he'd had in weeks, perhaps months. When he woke up, it was full dark. Every trace of red gone from the sky. He was chilled to the bone, but not damp. Under the dome, dew no longer fell.
12. While the chef was observing the face of Christ in that evening's infected sunset, Third Selectman Andrea Grinnell was sitting on her couch and trying to read. Her generator had quit, or had it ever run at all? She couldn't remember. But she had a gadget called a Mighty Bright Light that her sister Rose had tucked into her Christmas stocking last year. She'd never had occasion to use it until now, but it worked just fine. You clamped it to your book and turned it on. Easy peasy. So light wasn't a problem. The words, unfortunately, were. The words kept squirming around on the page, sometimes even changing places with each other. And Nora Roberts' prose, ordinarily crystal clear, made absolutely no sense. Yet Andrea kept trying, because she could think of nothing else to do. The house stank, even with the windows open. She was suffering diarrhea, and the toilet would no longer flush. She was hungry but couldn't eat. She had tried a sandwich around 5 p.m., just an inoffensive cheese sandwich, and had thrown it up in the kitchen wastebasket minutes after it was down. A shame, because eating that sandwich had been hard work. She was sweating heavily, had already changed her clothes once, probably should change them again, if she could manage to do it, and her feet kept jittering and jerking. They don't call it kicking the habit for nothing, she thought, and I'll never make the emergency meeting tonight if Jim still means to have one. Considering how her last conversation with Big Jim and Andy Sanders had gone, maybe that was good. If she showed up, they'd just bully her some more, make her do things she didn't want to do. Best she stay away until she was clear of this shit, she said, and brushed her damp hair out of her eyes. This fucking shit in my system. Once she was herself again, she would stand up to Jim Rennie. He was long overdue. She would do it in spite of her poor aching back, which was such a misery without her OxyContin, but not the white-hot agony she had expected. That was a welcome surprise. Rusty wanted her to take methadone. Methadone, for God's sake. Heroin under an alias. If you're thinking about going cold turkey, don't, he had told her. You're apt to have seizures. But he'd said it could take 10 days his way. And she didn't think she could wait that long. Not with this awful dome over the town. Best to get it over with. Having come to this conclusion, she had flushed all of her pills, not just the methadone, but a few last OxyContin pills she'd found in the back of her nightstand drawer, down the toilet. That had been just 2 flushes before the toilet gave up the ghost. And now she sat here shivering, and trying to convince herself she'd done the right thing. It was the only thing, she thought. That kind of takes the right and wrong out of it. She tried to turn the page of her book, and her stupid hand struck the Mighty Bright gadget. It went tumbling to the floor. The spot of brilliance it threw went up to the ceiling. Andrea looked at it, and was suddenly rising out of herself. And fast, it was like riding an invisible express elevator. She had just a moment to look down and see her body still on the couch, twitching helplessly. Foamy drool was slipping down her chin from her mouth. She saw the wetness spreading around the crotch of her jeans and thought, "Yep, I'll have to change again, all right. If I live through this, that is." Then she passed through the ceiling, through the bedroom above it, through the attic with its dark stacked boxes and retired lamps, and from there out into the night. The Milky Way sprawled above her, but it was wrong. The Milky Way had turned pink, and then began to fall. Somewhere, far, far below her, Andrea heard the body she had left behind. It was screaming. 13. Barbie thought he and Julia would discuss what had happened to Piper Libby on their ride out of town, but they were mostly silent, lost in their own thoughts. Neither of them said they were relieved when the unnatural red sunset finally began to fade,
but both of them were. Julia tried the radio once, found nothing but WCIK booming out All Prayed Up, and snapped it off again. Barbie spoke only once, this just after they turned off Route 119 and began to drive west along the narrower black top of the Motton Road, where woods bulked up close on either side. Did I do the right thing? In Julia's opinion, he had done a great many right things during the confrontation in the chief's office, including the successful treatment of two patients with dislocations. But she knew what he was talking about.
Yes, it was the exquisitely wrong time to try asserting command.
He agreed, but felt tired and dispirited and not equal to the job he was beginning to see before him. I'm sure the enemies of Hitler said pretty much the same thing. They said it in 1934 and they were right, in 36 and they were right, also in 38. The wrong time to challenge him, they said. And when they realized the right time had finally come, they were protesting in Auschwitz or Buchenwald.
This is not the same, she said.
You think not? She made no reply to this, but saw his point. Hitler had been a paper hanger, or so the story went. Jim Rennie was a used car dealer, 601, half a dozen of the other. Up ahead, fingers of brilliance shone through the trees. They printed an intaglio of shadows on the patched tar of Motton Road. There were a number of military trucks parked on the other side of the dome. It was Harlow over there at this edge of town, and 30 or 40 soldiers moved hither and yon with a purpose. All had gas masks hooked to their belts. A silver tanker truck bearing the legend, "Extreme Danger, Keep Back," had been backed up until it almost touched a door-sized shape that had been spray-painted on the dome's surface. A plastic hose was clamped to a valve on the back of the tanker. Two men were handling the hose, which ended in a wand no bigger than the barrel of a Bic pen. These men were wearing shiny all-over suits and helmets. There were air tanks on their backs. On the Chester's Mill side, there was only one spectator. Lissa Jameson, the town librarian, stood beside an old-fashioned lady's Schwinn with a milk box carrier on the rear fender. On the back of the box was a sticker reading, "When the power of love is stronger than the love of power, the world will know peace." Jimi Hendrix. "What are you doing out here, Lissa?" Julia asked, getting out of her car. She held up a hand to shield her eyes from the bright lights. Lissa was nervously fiddling with the ankh she wore around her neck on a silver chain. She looked from Julia to Barbie, then back to Julia again.
"I go for a ride on my bike when I'm upset or worried. Sometimes I ride until midnight. It soothes my pneuma. I saw the lights and came to the lights."
She said this in an incantatory way and let go of her ankh long enough to trace some kind of complicated symbol in the air.
"What are you doing out here?"
"Came to watch an experiment," Barbie said. "If it works, you can be the first one to leave Chester's Mill." Lissa smiled. It looked a little forced, but Barbie liked her for the effort.
"If I did that, I'd miss the Tuesday night special at Sweetbriar. Isn't it usually meatloaf?"
"Meatloaf's the plan," he agreed, not adding that if the dome was still in place the following Tuesday, the spécialité de la maison was apt to be zucchini quiche.
"They won't talk," Lissa said. "I tried."
A squat fireplug of a man came out from behind the tanker and into the light. He was dressed in khakis, a poplin jacket, and a hat with the logo of the Maine Black Bears on it. The first thing to strike Barbie was that James O. Cox had put on weight. The second was his heavy jacket, zipped to what was now dangerously close to a double chin. Nobody else, Barbie, Julia, or Lissa, was wearing a jacket. There was no need of them on their side of the dome. Cox saluted. Barbie gave it back, and it actually felt pretty good to snap one off. "Hello, Barbie," Cox said. "How's Ken?" "Ken's fine," Barbie said, "and I continue to be the bitch that gets all the good shit." "Not this time, Colonel," Cox said. "This time it appears you got fucked at the drive-thru." 14.
"Who's he?" Lissa whispered.
She was still working at the ankh. Julia thought she'd snap the chain soon if she kept at it.
"And what are they doing over there?"
"Trying to get us out," Julia said. "And after the rather spectacular failure earlier in the day, I'd have to say they're wise to do it on the quiet." She started forward.
"Hello, Colonel Cox. I'm your favorite newspaper editor. Good evening."
Cox's smile was, to his credit, she thought, only slightly sour.
Ms. Shumway, you're even prettier than I imagined.
I'll say one thing for you, you're handy with the bullshit.
Barbie intercepted her 3 yards from where Cox was standing and took her by the arms.
What?
She asked. The camera. She had almost forgotten she had it around her neck until he pointed to it.
Is it digital?
Sure, Pete Freeman's extra.
She started to ask why, then got it.
You think the dome will fry it?
That'd be the best case scenario, Barbie said. Remember what happened to Chief Perkins' pacemaker.
Shit,
she said.
Shit! Maybe I've got my old Kodak in the trunk.
Lissa and Cox were looking at each other with what Barbie thought was equal fascination.
What are you going to do? She asked. Is there going to be another bang?
Cox hesitated. Barbie said, might as well come clean, Colonel. If you don't tell her, I will. Cox sighed.
You insist on total transparency, don't you?
Why not? If this thing works, the people of Chester's Mill will be singing your praises. The only reason you're playing them close is force of habit.
No, that's what my superiors have ordered.
They're in Washington, Barbie said. And the press is in Castle Rock, most of them probably watching Girls Gone Wild on pay-per-view. Out here, it's just us chickens. Cox sighed and pointed to the spray-painted door shape.
That's where the men in the protective suits will apply our experimental compound. If we're lucky, the acid will eat through, and we'll then be able to knock that piece of the dome out the way you can knock a piece of glass out of a window, after you've used a glass cutter.
And if we're unlucky, Barbie asked, if the dome decomposes, giving off some poison gas that kills us all? Is that what the gas masks are for?
Actually, Cox said, the scientists feel it more likely that the acid might start a chemical reaction that would cause the dome to catch fire.
He saw Lissa's stricken expression and added, they consider both possibilities very remote.
They can, Lissa said, twirling her ankh. They're not the ones who'd get gassed or roasted.
Cox said, I understand your concern, ma'am.
Melissa, Barbie corrected.
It suddenly seemed important to him that Cox understand these were people under the dome, not just a few thousand anonymous taxpayers. Melissa Jameson. Lissa to her friends. She's the town librarian. She's also the middle school guidance counselor, and teaches yoga classes, I believe.
I had to give that up, Lissa said with a fretful smile. Too many other things to do.
Very nice to make your acquaintance, Miss Jameson. Cox said, look, this is a chance worth taking.
If we felt differently, could we stop you? She asked.
This Cox did not answer directly.
There's no sign that this thing, whatever it is weakening or biodegrading unless we're able to breach it. We believe you're in for the long haul.
Do you have any idea what caused it? Any at all?
None, Cox said.
But his eyes shifted in a way Rusty Everett would have recognized from his conversation with Big Jim. Barbie thought, why are you lying? Just that knee-jerk reaction again? Civilians are like mushrooms, keep them in the dark and feed them shit.
Probably that was all it was, but it made him nervous. It's strong, Lissa asked. Your acid, is it strong?
The most corrosive in existence, as far as we know, Cox replied.
And Lissa took 2 large steps back. Cox turned to the men in the spacesuits.
Are you boys about ready?
They gave him a pair of gloved thumbs up. Behind them, all activity had stopped. The soldiers stood watching with their hands on their gas masks.
Here we go, Cox said. Barbie, I suggest you escort those 2 beautiful ladies at least 50 yards back from...
Look at the stars, Julia said. Her voice was soft, awestruck.
Her head was tilted upward, and in her wondering face, Barbie saw the child she had been 30 years ago. He looked up and saw the Big Dipper, the Great Bear, Orion. All where they belonged, except they had smeared out of clear focus and turned pink. The Milky Way had turned into a bubblegum spill across the greater dome of the night.
Cox, he said, do you see that?
Cox looked up.
See what, the stars?
What do they look like to you?
Well, very bright, of course, no light pollution to speak of in these parts.
Then a thought occurred to him, and he snapped his fingers.
What are you seeing? Have they changed color?
They're beautiful, Lissa said. Her eyes were wide and shining. But scary, too. They're pink, Julia said. What's happening?
Nothing, Cox said, but he sounded oddly reluctant. What? Barbie asked. Spill it. And added without thinking, Sir? We got the meteorological report at 1900 hours, Cox said. Special emphasis on winds, just in case. Well, just in case. Leave it at that. The jet stream's currently coming west as far as Nebraska or Kansas, dipping south, then coming up the eastern seaboard. Pretty common pattern for late October.
What's that got to do with the stars?
As it comes north, the jet passes over a lot of cities and manufacturing towns. What it picks up over those locations is collecting on the dome, instead of being whisked north to Canada and the Arctic. There's enough of it now to have created a kind of optical filter. I'm sure it's not dangerous.
Not yet, Julia said. But what about in a week or a month? Are you going to hose down our airspace at 30,000 feet when it starts getting dark in here?
Before Cox could reply, Lissa Jameson screamed and pointed into the sky. Then she covered her face. The pink stars were falling, leaving bright cone trails behind them.
15.
More dope,
Piper said dreamily as Rusty listened to her heartbeat. Rusty patted Piper's right hand. The left one was badly scraped.
No more dope, he said. You're officially stoned.
Jesus wants me to have more dope, she said in that same dreamy voice. I want to get as high as a mockingbird pie.
I believe that's elephant's eye, but I'll take it under consideration.
She sat up. Rusty tried to push her back down, but he dared push on only her right shoulder, and that wasn't enough.
Will I be able to get out of here tomorrow? I have to see Chief Randolph. Those boys raped Sammy Bushy.
And could have killed you, he said. Dislocation or not, you fell extremely lucky. Let me worry about Sammy.
Those cops are dangerous.
She put her right hand on his wrist.
They can't go on being police. They'll hurt someone else.
She licked her lips.
My mouth is so dry.
I can fix that, but you'll have to lie down.
Did you take sperm samples from Sammy? Can you match them to the boys? If you can, I'll hound Peter Randolph until he makes them give DNA samples. I'll hound him day and night.
We're not equipped for DNA matching, Rusty said. Also, there are no sperm samples because Gina Buffalino washed her up at Sammy's own request.
I'll get you something to drink. All the fridges except for the ones in the lab are turned off to save juice. But there's an igloo cooler at the nurse's station.
Juice, she said, closing her eyes. Yes. Juice would be good. Orange or apple. Not V8. Too salty.
Apple, he said. You're on clear liquids tonight. Piper whispered,
I miss my dog.
Then turned her head away. Rusty thought she'd probably be out by the time he got back with her juice box. Halfway down the corridor, Twitch rounded the corner from the nurse's station at a dead run. His eyes were wide and wild.
Come outside, Rusty. As soon as I get Reverend Livia... No, now, you have to see this.
Rusty hurried back to room 29 and peeped in. Piper was snoring in a most unladylike way, not unusual, considering her swelled nose. He followed Twitch down the corridor, almost running to keep up with the other man's long strides.
What is it? Meaning, what now? I can't explain. You probably wouldn't believe me if I did. You have to see it for yourself.
He banged out through the lobby door. Standing in the driveway beyond the protective canopy where drop-off patients arrived were Ginny Tomlinson, Gina Buffalino, and Harriet Bigelow, a friend whom Gina had recruited to help out at the hospital. The three of them had their arms around each other, as if for comfort, and were staring up into the sky. It was filled with blazing pink stars, and many appeared to be falling, leaving long, almost fluorescent trails behind them. A shudder worked up Rusty's back. Judy foresaw this, he thought. The pink stars are falling in lines. And they were. They were. It was as if heaven itself was coming down around their ears.
16.
Alice and Aiden Appleton were asleep when the pink stars began falling, but Thurston Marshall and Carolyn Sturgis weren't. They stood in the backyard of the Dumagen house and watched them come down in brilliant pink lines. Some of the lines crisscrossed each other, and when this happened, pink runes seemed to stand out in the sky before fading. "Is it the end of the world?" Caroline asked.
"Not at all," he said. "It's a meteor swarm. They're most commonly observed during autumn here in New England. I think it's too late in the year for the Perseids. So this one's probably a wandering shower, maybe dust and chunks of rock from an asteroid that broke up a trillion years ago. Think of that, Caro."
She didn't want to. "Are meteor showers always pink?"
"No," he said. "I think it probably looks white on the outside of the dome, but we're seeing it through a film of dust and particulate matter. Pollution, in other words. It's changed the color."
She thought about that as they watched the silent pink tantrum in the sky. "There's the little boy, Aiden. When he had that fit, or whatever it was, he said..."
"I remember what he said. The pink stars are falling. They make lines behind them."
"How could he know that?" Thurston only shook his head. Carolyn hugged him tighter. At times like this, although there had never been a time exactly like this in her life, she was glad Thurston was old enough to be her father. Right now, she wished he was her father. How could he know this was coming? How could he know? 17. Aiden had said something else during his moment of prophecy. "Everyone is watching." And by 9:30 on that Monday night, when the meteor shower was at its height, that was true. The news spreads by cell phone and email, but mostly in the old way, mouth to ear. By 9:45, Main Street is full of people watching the silent fireworks display. Most are equally silent. A few are crying. Leo Lemoyne, a faithful member of the late Reverend Coggins' Holy Redeemer congregation, shouts it's the apocalypse, that he sees the four horsemen in the sky, that the rapture will begin soon, etc., etc. Sloppy Sam Verdreau, back on the street again since 3 that afternoon, sober and grumpy, tells Leo that if Leo doesn't shut up about the crock of shit, he'll be seeing his own stars. Rupe Libby of the CMPD, hand on the butt of his gun, tells them both to shut the hell up and stop scaring people. As if they're not scared already. Willow and Tommy Anderson are in the parking lot of Dippers, Willow crying with her head on Tommy's shoulder. Rose Twitchell stands beside Anson Wheeler outside Sweetbriar Rose. Both are still wearing their aprons, and they also have their arms around each other. Norrie Calvert and Benny Drake are with their parents. And when Norrie's hand steals into Benny's, he takes it with a thrill the falling pink stars cannot match. Jack Cale, the current manager of Food City, is in the supermarket parking lot. Jack called Ernie Calvert, the previous manager, late that afternoon and asked if Ernie would help him do a complete inventory of supplies on hand. They were well into this job, hoping to be done by midnight when the furor on Main Street broke out. Now they stand, side by side, watching the pink stars fall. Stewart and Fernald Bowie are outside their funeral parlor, gazing up. Henry Morrison and Jackie Weddington stand across from the funeral parlor with Chaz Bender, who teaches history up to the high school. "It's just a meteor shower, seen through a haze of pollution," Chaz tells Jackie and Henry. But he still sounds odd. The fact that accumulating particulate matter has actually changed the color of the stars brings the situation home to people in a new way, and gradually, the weeping becomes more widespread. It is a soft sound, almost like rain. Big Jim is less interested in a bunch of meaningless lights in the sky than he is in how people will interpret those lights. Tonight, he expects they'll just go home. Tomorrow, though, things may be different. And the fear he sees on most faces may not be such a bad thing. Fearful people need strong leaders. And if there's one thing Big Jim Rennie knows he can provide, it's strong leadership. He's outside the police station doors with Chief Randolph and Andy Sanders. Standing below them, crowded together, are his problem children, Thibodeau, Searles, the rude Chippy, Junior's friend, Frank. Big Jim descends the steps that Libby fell down earlier. "She could have done us all a favor if she'd broken her neck," he thinks, and taps Frankie on the shoulder. "Enjoying the show, Frankie?" The boy's big, scared eyes make him look 12 instead of 22 or whatever he is. "What is it, Mr. Rennie, do you know?"
Meteor shower, just God saying hello to his people.
Frank de Lesseps relaxes a little.
We're going back inside, Big Jim says, jerking his thumb at Randolph and Andy, who are still watching the sky. We'll talk for a while, then I'll call you four in. I want you all to tell the same cotton-picking story when I do. Have you got that?
Yes, Mr. Rennie, Frankie says.
Mel Searles looks at Big Jim, his eyes like saucers and his mouth hanging loose. Big Jim thinks the boy looks like his IQ might reach all the way up to 70. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, either.
It looks like the end of the world, Mr. Rennie, he says.
Nonsense. Are you saved, son?
I guess so, Mel says.
Then you have nothing to worry about.
Big Jim surveys them one by one, ending with Carter Thibodeau. On the way to salvation tonight, young man, is all of you telling the same story.
Not everyone sees the pink stars. Like the Appleton kids, Rusty Everett's little jays are fast asleep. So is Piper. So is Andre Grinnell. So is the chef, sprawled on the dead grass beside what might be America's biggest methamphetamine lab. Ditto Brenda Perkins, who cried herself to sleep on her couch with the Vader printout scattered on the coffee table before her. The dead also do not see, unless they look from a brighter place than this darkling plain where ignorant armies clash by night. Myra Evans, Duke Perkins, Chuck Thompson, and Claudette Sanders are tucked away in the Bowie funeral home. Dr. Haskell, Mr. Carty, and Rory Dinsmore are in the morgue of Catherine Russell Hospital. Lester Coggins, Dodie Sanders, and Angie McCain are still hanging out in the McCain pantry. So is Junior. He is between Dodie and Angie, holding their hands. His head aches, but only a little. He thinks he might sleep the night here. On Mountain Road in Eastchester, not far from the place where the attempt to breach the dome with an experimental acid compound is even then going on beneath the strange pink sky, Jack Evans, husband of the late Myra, is standing in his backyard with a bottle of Jack Daniels in one hand and his home protection weapon of choice, a Ruger SR-9, in the other. He drinks and watches the pink stars fall. He knows what they are, and he wishes on every one. And he wishes for death, because without Myra, the bottom has dropped out of his life. He might be able to live without her, and he might be able to live like a rat in a glass cage, but he cannot manage both. When the falling meteors become more intermittent, this is around 10:15, about 45 minutes after the shower began, he swallows the last of the Jack, casts the bottle onto the grass, and blows his brains out. He is the mill's first official suicide. He will not be the last. 18. Barbie, Julia, and Lissa Jameson watched silently as the two space-suited soldiers removed the thin nozzle from the end of the plastic hose. They put it into an opaque plastic bag with a Ziploc top, then put the bag into a metal case, stenciled with the words hazardous materials. They locked it with separate keys, then took off their helmets. They looked tired, hot, and out of spirits. Two older men, too old to be soldiers, wheeled a complicated-looking piece of equipment away from the site of the acid experiment, which had been performed 3 times. Barbie guessed the older guys, possibly scientists from NSA, had been doing some sort of spectrographic analysis. Or trying to. The gas masks they had been wearing during the testing procedure were now pushed up on top of their heads like weird hats. Barbie could have asked Cox what the tests were supposed to show, and Cox might even have given him a straight answer, but Barbie was also out of spirits. Overhead, the last few pink meteoroids were zipping down the sky. Lissa pointed back toward Eastchester.
I heard something that sounded like a gunshot. Did you?
Probably a car backfiring or some kid shooting off a bottle rocket, Julia said. She was also tired and drawn. Once, when it became clear that the experiment, the acid test, so to speak, wasn't going to work, Barbie had caught her wiping her eyes. It hadn't stopped her from taking pictures, with her Kodak, though. Cox walked toward them, his shadow thrown in 2 different directions by the lights that had been set up. He gestured to the place where the door shape had been sprayed on the dome.
I guess this little adventure cost the American taxpayer about $750,000, and that's not counting the R&D expenses that went into developing the acid compound, which ate the paint we sprayed on there and did absolutely fuck all else.
Language, Colonel, Julia said with a ghost of her old smile.
Thank you, Madam Editor,
Cox said sourly. Did you really think this would work? Barbie asked.
No, but I didn't think I'd ever live to see a man on Mars, either. But the Russians say they're going to send a crew of 4 in 2020.
Oh, I get it, Julia said. The Martians got wind of it and they're pissed.
If so, they retaliated in the wrong country, Cox said.
And Barbie saw something in his eyes. How sure are you, Jim? He asked softly.
I beg pardon?
That the dome was put in place by extraterrestrials.
Julia took 2 steps forward. Her face was pale, her eyes blazing.
Tell us what you know, goddammit.
Cox raised his hand.
Stop. We don't know anything. There is a theory, however. Yes. Marty, come over here.
One of the older gentlemen who had been running tests approached the dome. He was holding his gas mask by the strap.
Your analysis?
Cox asked. And when he saw the older gentleman's hesitation,
speak freely.
Well, Marty shrugged.
Trace minerals. Soil and airborne pollutants. Otherwise, nothing. According to spectrographic analysis, that thing isn't there. What about the HY908?
And to Barbie and the women, the acid.
It's gone, Marty said.
The thing that isn't there ate it up.
Is that possible, according to what you know?
No, but the dome isn't possible, according to what we know.
And does that lead you to believe that the dome may be the creation of some life form with more advanced knowledge of physics, chemistry, biology, whatever?
When Marty hesitated again, Cox repeated what he'd said earlier.
Speak freely.
It's one possibility. It's also possible that some earthly supervillain set it up. A real-world Lex Luthor. Or it could be the work of a renegade country like North Korea.
Who hasn't taken credit for it? Barbie asked skeptically.
I lean toward extraterrestrial, Marty said.
He knocked on the dome without wincing. He'd already gotten his little shock from it.
So do most of the scientists working on this right now. If we can be said to be working when we're not actually doing anything. It's the Sherlock rule. When you eliminate the impossible, the answer, no matter how improbable, is what remains.
Has anyone or anything landed in a flying saucer and demanded to be taken to our leader? Julia asked.
No, Cox said.
Would you know if something had? Barbie asked, and thought, are we having this discussion, or am I dreaming it?
Not necessarily,
Cox said, after a brief hesitation.
It could still be meteorological, Marty said. Hell, even biological, a living thing. There's a school of thought that this thing is actually some kind of E. coli hybrid.
Colonel Cox, Julia said quietly. Are we something's experiment? Because that's what I feel like.
Lissa Jameson, meanwhile, was looking back toward the nice houses of the Eastchester Burblet. Most of the lights there were out, either because the people who lived there had no generators, or were saving them.
That was a gunshot, she said. I'm sure that was a gunshot.
Feeling it. 1. Other than town politics, Big Jim Rennie had only one vice, and that was high school girls' basketball. Lady Wildcats basketball, to be exact. He'd had season tickets ever since 1998 and attended at least a dozen games a year. In 2004, the year the Lady Wildcats won the state Class D championship, he attended all of them. And although the autographs people noticed when they were invited into his home study were inevitably those of Tiger Woods, Dale Earnhardt, and Bill Spaceman Lee, the one of which he was proudest, the one he treasured, was Hannah Compton's. The little sophomore point guard,
who had led the Lady Wildcats to that one and only gold ball.
When you're a season ticket holder, you get to know the other season ticket holders around you and their reasons for being fans of the game. Many are relatives of the girls who play, and often the spark plugs of the booster club, putting on bake sales and raising money for the increasingly expensive away games. Others are basketball purists who will tell you, with some justification, that the girls' games are just better. Young female players are invested in a team ethic that the boys, who love to run and gun, dunk and shoot from way downtown, rarely match. The pace is slower, allowing you to see inside the game and enjoy every pick and roll or give and go. Fans of the girls' game relish the very low scores that boys' basketball fans sneer at, claiming that the girls' game puts a premium on defense and foul shooting, which are the very definition of old-school hoops. There are also guys who just like to watch long-legged teenage girls run around in short pants. Big Jim shared all these reasons for enjoying the sport. But his passion sprang from another source entirely, one he never vocalized when discussing the games with his fellow fans. It would not have been politic to do so. The girls took the sport personally, and that made them better haters. The boys wanted to win, yes, and sometimes a game could get hot if it was against a traditional rival. In the case of the Mills Wildcat sports teams, the despised Castle Rock Rockets. But mostly with the boys, it was about individual accomplishments, showing off, in other words, and when it was over, it was over. The girls, on the other hand, loathed losing. They took loss back to the locker room and brooded over it. More importantly, they loathed and hated it as a team. Big Jim often saw that hate rear its head. During a loose ball brawl deep in the second half with the score tied, he could pick up that, "No you don't, you little bitch, that ball is mine," vibe. He picked it up and fed on it. Before 2004, the Lady Wildcats made the state tournament only once in 20 years, that appearance a one-and-done affair against Buckfield. Then had come Hannah Compton, the greatest hater of all time, in Big Jim's opinion. As the daughter of Dale Compton, a scrawny pulp cutter from Tarker's Mills who was usually drunk and always argumentative, Hannah had come by her out-of-my-face tood naturally enough. As a freshman, she had played JV for most of the season. Coach swung her up to varsity only for the last two games, where she'd outscored everyone and left her opposite number from the Richmond Bobcats writhing on the hardwood after a hard but clean defensive play. When that game was over, Big Jim had collared Coach Woodhead. "If that girl doesn't start next year, you're crazy," he said. "I'm not crazy," Coach Woodhead had replied. Hannah had started hot and finished hotter, blazing a trail that Wildcats fans would still be talking about years later. Season average 27.6 points per game. She could spot up and drop a three-pointer anytime she wanted, but what Big Jim liked best was to watch her split the defense and drive for the basket, her pug face set in a sneer of concentration, her bright black eyes daring anyone to get in her way, her short ponytail sticking out behind her like a raised middle finger. The Mills' second selectman and premier used car dealer had fallen in love. In the 2004 championship game, the Lady Wildcats had been leading the Rock Rockets by 10 when Hannah fouled out. Luckily for the Cats, there was only a buck 16 left to play. They ended up winning by a single point. Of their 86 total points, Hannah Compton had scored a brain-freezing 63. That spring, her argumentative dad had ended up behind the wheel of a brand new Cadillac, sold to him at cost, minus 40% by James Rennie Sr. New cars weren't Big Jim's business, but when he wanted one, off the back of the carrier, he could always get it. Sitting in Peter Randolph's office with the last of the pink meteor shower still fading away outside, and his problem children waiting, anxiously Big Jim hoped, to be summoned and told their fate. Big Jim recalled that fabulous, that outright mythic basketball game. Specifically the first 8 minutes of the second half, which had begun with the Lady Wildcats down by 9. Hannah had taken the game over with the single-minded brutality of Joseph Stalin taking over Russia, her black eyes glittering and seemingly fixed upon some basketball nirvana beyond the sight of normal mortals.
her face locked in that eternal sneer that said, I'm better than you, I'm the best, get out of my way, or I'll run you the fuck down. Everything she threw up during that 8 minutes had gone in, including one absurd half-court shot that she launched when her feet tangled.